traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Raise a spoon to Grandma, who always took all the hungry cousins to McDonald's for McNuggets and the play slide. Have something sweet in her honor. Come to McDonald's and treat yourself to the Grandma McFlurry today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
Hello all and welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. Once again, I'm Eric Rivenis and thanks for joining me. Well, I've got to say I've had a great couple of recent episodes courtesy of our amazing listeners. Matt from Nova Scotia emailed me with a suggestion that I contact Bill or Rachel McCarthy James about their Man from the Train book, which I did, of course. I appreciate that so much, Matt. And another listener, Ron, forwarded me the article that my next guest wrote. Thank you, Ron. And you can email me as well with your favorite books, true crime history books, please, at erivenis@yahoo.com, or just go to mostnotorious.com and hit the send me a wire link. I'm also excited to announce that I reached my 1,000 rating goal on iTunes. Again, thanks to everyone who left one for me. Great to know that you guys all have my back. Appreciate it, as always. Now, let's move on to our interview. I'm joined now by Kim Brigeman, longtime reporter and history writer for Montana's Missoulian newspaper. His recent article is titled, "Curious Find Casts Doubt on 1922 Execution." Thanks so much for joining me, and I'm so pleased that you're able to share with us this new information on an almost 100-year-old case.
It's a fun story.
Is this a pretty well-known story for armchair historians in Montana?
For a certain set, I think it is. But really, it was long past the general, you know, public's memory. The main personalities are all long gone, and their families are unknown, at least to me. So
let's jump right in. Nora Shea's murder. It happened in Missoula, 1921. What were the circumstances of her death?
The incident in 1921 occurred on the north side of Missoula. Jerry Shea was a railroad worker, and he and Mrs. Shea and their two young children lived right next to the tracks in North Missoula. Mrs. Shea had previously had a run-in with Joe Vukovic, who was a Serbian who was also living in that neighborhood, and it appeared that they had an affair going. On the day of the murder, on the evening of that murder, it was after dark, Mr. Shea testified that Mrs. Shea was walking down to the nearby store, corner grocery store, to get candy, as the family was planning on taking a trip up the Bitterroot, which is where both the Shays were from. The report was that a 13-year-old boy saw Mrs. Shea and Joe Vukovich walking together towards the store along North First Street in Missoula, and then they appeared to get in an argument, according to this 13-year-old. I think he was a paperboy at the time. Then a shot rang out, as happens, and Mrs. Shea was left dying on the corner of Rose Avenue and First Street. Reports, witnesses said they saw Joe Vukovich leaving after that, and he went on the lam for 4 or 5 days before he was finally caught. So he immediately appeared guilty, but that was cast in doubt at the subsequent trial, and also in later years by this confession board that Cliff Iverson, who lives in Missoula now and has most of his life, produced a few weeks ago.
So there had been some history between Joe Vukovich and Mrs. Shea. Your article offers some details about their relationship.
The most glaring incident happened just a few weeks earlier. The murder was on February 12, 1921, and on January 25th, the neighbors called the police because there was a disturbance at the Shea house, and Joe Vukovich was seen leaving with her two young children, who were 2.5 and 5 years old, carrying them out to the street. When Mrs. Shea protested, he turned around and put the children down, apparently, and slapped her or did something to bloody her nose. Then he left with an accomplice, so to speak, in a car at that time. So the police at that incident seemed to indicate that there was something, a relationship going on between Joe and Nora Shea, that Jerry Shea was aware of, but seemed to be intimidated by Joe Vukovich and wasn't doing anything about it.
It was kind of a weird love triangle. He lived close by and seemed to be over there a lot, right?
Correct, yeah. And the other entanglement that we'll never know is they seem to both be involved in bootlegging. It was, you know, the height of prohibition, so to speak, early in the height of prohibition. And Joe had already been arrested for bootlegging, and in fact, in just the week before the murder, and was released. So there was that, you know, maze that I can't circumnavigate with all the connections.
He was already kind of a well-known character with a criminal background when he was arrested.
Yes. Yes, the neighbors knew him as Joe Vines, and their initial reports called him Joe Vines, Joe Vukovich. The headline the day after the murder called him Joe Vukovich, and so there was all kinds of pseudonyms, I guess, involved there. But I keep with Joe Vukovich, which was the closest to what he came to be referred to in the papers.
He's not caught right away, though.
Yeah, it's interesting. He fled west out of Missoula. The first major drainage out of Missoula to the west is Grant Creek, and he knocked on the door in the early morning hours after that evening murder, and knocked on the door of a rancher, E.C. Henry, who he told that the law was after, and this time I'm probably going to hang. And when Henry asked him why he said that, he answered, because they got me for bootlegging again. He never said anything about a murder. After he stayed for part of that day at the Henry Ranch, Mr. Henry went to town to get some food or something and found out. When he came back, he found that Joe had left and stolen some clothes and some food. Joe then apparently, or as he had reported after he was caught, he took off east of Missoula out toward, up the Clark Fork River drainage, as it were. And it wasn't until February 16th, so 4 days after the murder, that he was seen limping along hungry on the railroad tracks 35 miles east of Missoula. And a train crew reported him, and the Missoula sheriff deputy went out and caught him and brought him back to Missoula.
He was not only having a relationship with her, but they were planning to run away together, right?
That came out at the trial.
Okay.
Yes. Well, at least that's what the defender was portraying the scenario, is that Mrs. Shea was, Joe had convinced Mrs. Shea to bring the children back to Serbia, where he was from, and run away from her husband.
But the fact that he ran right after the murder didn't exactly help his case.
Exactly. When he went on the lam, and, you know, the headline again that I referred to in the next morning's paper, just a few hours actually after the murder, the lead headline is Mrs. Jerry Shea is murdered by Joe Vaklovich. And the subhead says that talk of a lynching is heard. So obviously he was considered the prime suspect right off the bat because he disappeared and because of his past history of violence with Mrs. Shea and actually other women.
Oh, okay. So he had a record of violence towards women.
Yeah. In the years leading up to this, he had been a laborer up in the Bitterroot, which is south of Missoula, and supposedly was run out of two towns up there for affairs with married women that ended violently when he struck them or assaulted them.
It's such a strange statement when he said that he was worried about getting executed for bootlegging. That wasn't a capital crime in Montana. Not there or anywhere else, I don't think.
Correct. And so that, all of that, which came out, in the days following the incident, but then also was revisited in the trial the next month, all of that did Joe no good in his defense.
So I'd love to ask you about the trial, if you don't mind. You've already talked a little bit about the defense strategy. They basically tried to direct the blame at her husband, right?
Well, they tried two strategies. One was to try to pin it on suicide, that Mrs. Shea was distraught. That had some merit in itself, but I think the main strategy was to try to pin it on Jerry Shea. And when he was asked by the defense attorney, did you shoot your wife? He flat out said, No. He said he had ejected Vukovic from his home back in January 25th when he assaulted Mrs. Shea. He said he denied that he had received $1,500. He, being Jerry Shea, denied at trial that he'd received $1,500 from Vukovic. And he also denied that he knew that Mrs. Shea took money belonging to Vukovic out of the bank on the day of the shooting. And so that was when he was asked, Jerry Shea was asked, didn't you know about a proposition between your wife and Vukovic where she would get a divorce and marry him and go back to Serbia with him? And Jerry Shea said no. And then he was asked, didn't you go to see about a divorce from your wife? Jerry answered no. And he answered no to, didn't your wife on several occasions threaten to shoot herself? So that was the motive that Jerry Shea would have had to kill her. The last thing that they asked Mr. Shea on the stand was, didn't your wife on several occasions threatened to shoot herself? And he answered again, no. So he was, they were trying to cast the guilt or suspicion on Jerry Shea, because there was obviously some evidence that he and his wife were on the outs and that Joe Vukovic would not have killed her because she was going to run away with him.
Interesting. So how long did the trial last, and how long did it take for the jury to reach a verdict?
Yeah. It lasted, I think it was over a span of 10 days. There were, you know, weekends when they didn't trial. So it was a long trial, but it took the jury of 12 men only 3 hours to come to a verdict, not only of guilty, but that he should be sentenced to death.
Did Montana have a death row at that time?
There were several people who had recently been, actually their sentences had been commuted by the sitting governor. And, but had been sentenced to death. So yes, I assume there were men on death row in prison at that time.
How long was it between the verdict and the sentence to the execution?
The sentence occurred apparently right that day, at the end of the trial in late March. He was sentenced originally to die in May of 1921. Because of the subsequent appeals, it didn't happen. The actual execution didn't happen till February of 1922, a year and 5 days after the murder.
Could you describe the execution?
Yeah, Joe was, by that time, he was quite a celebrity. In fact, they had rousted out some 5,000 signatures from Missoula County and surrounding areas to petition Governor Joseph Dixon to commute his sentence, as he had done recently, just a couple of others. And so Joe maintained his innocence to the end, and he actually wrote a letter on the night before. The hanging occurred at 6 o'clock in the morning on February 17th. On the day leading up to it, he wrote a letter that the Missoulian newspaper published the day of the hanging, that basically thanked all of those who had petitioned for his life. And then it also said that they're hanging the wrong guy. And even as they slipped the noose on on him in the jail yard behind the Missoula jail. The account said Sheriff Cole adjusted the noose under Bukovich's ear and asked, "Have you anything to say, Joe?" And Joe swallowed. Then he spoke clearly. "I have this to say, that I pray to God and Jesus Christ that they take the one who got me into this and take him and punish him worse than I get punished this morning. I hope Christ burns him in the fire. Of course, I am losing my life as innocent as any man that ever was hung. And that is all I have to say." It is instrumental, or it is instructive, to note that he did not testify on his own behalf at the trial. And there were various reasons put forward for that, but never was quite sure why his defense attorney did not put him on the stand at the trial.
Do you think that would have helped his case?
I can't outguess the defense attorney, who seems competent from all I've read. There must have been something else there that he was afraid that Joe would be pinned down to say. And so there could well have been some kind of collusion even between Joe and Jerry to murder Mrs. Shea. You know, it leaves open all that kind of speculation.
Interesting. So there is definitely a chance, in your opinion, that Jerry Shea killed his wife.
Yes, I do. I do think so, because for one thing, he was on the scene while she lay there in a pool of blood. She'd been shot in the head. He was there quickly, and one of the strange things that happened at that time was, and this was in the account in the papers the next day, he put a knee. He was kneeling beside her with one knee on her. And when somebody said, "What are you doing?" all he replied was, "She is my wife." And they left that incident hanging, which seems really strange.
Yeah.
She was unconscious, and she actually was taken to the hospital shortly thereafter and died at the hospital, never regaining consciousness. So, that was a strange incident that really cast questions in my own mind when I read it about why Jerry Shea would have done that.
That makes me think of a murder that happened in Minneapolis at the turn of the 20th century, where a man had taken his wife for a walk along a steep river bluff and pushed her over. When he climbed down and realized she was still alive, he rushed to her side, grabbed her arms, and started violently shaking her, telling her to stay alive. "Come back to me, come back to me." It's very similar.
Yep. And who knows what that was all about, other than, you know, just what they said it was. You had asked about details of the hanging, and I think we should mention how that went down. I got a lot of this information from a book that a guy named Ted Donovan wrote, which chronicles all the hangings and tells their stories in Montana, and a very valuable book. But it was, he characterized that murder, or that hanging, as he was the last man in Montana to be hanged on a jerk-type gallows, which consisted of, instead of a drop through a trap door, they put a 320-pound weight on the other end of the rope, hung it over the gallows, and then dropped the rope and pulled the man sentenced to die was hopefully to break his neck immediately. It took him 10 and a half minutes, so that didn't work as quickly and expeditiously as it was planned. Jerry was characterized by the time he died as a 140-pound man, and so the 320-pound weight would have been pretty devastating, it seems like. So.
And there were a lot of people who showed up to watch the hanging. It was quite a spectacle.
Yeah, and in that way, it lives on in Missoula history because the invitations were sent out to 200 people. And a lot of those invitations, or some of them at least, are still around in collections and museums and so forth in Missoula. They built a stockade around the back of the jail, a 10-foot-high stockade. And they were afraid of some disturbances, some violence, some protests, because that's why they built the stockade. Beyond the 200 witnesses that were invited, the story goes that there were men and children who were on rooftops and who climbed trees that morning to see the event. So I saw one estimate that maybe a thousand people saw Joe Vukovich die.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, she...
Or call the police,
like she should have, exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the Golden Age of Piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
What was the population of Missoula at that time, approximately?
Ooh, you got me. Yeah, I do know, you know, when they said he got, there were 5,000 petitions or signatures on petition to spare his life, that equaled roughly a fourth of the Missoula County population at the time in the early 1920s. I would have to check that figure, but that sticks in my mind that there were perhaps in the county itself 20,000 to 25,000 people.
So, if you don't mind, let's go to this piece of evidence you wrote about. This board, the board that was found by Cliff Iverson. Could you describe it for us?
Well, the curious thing about it is that anyone would take the time to write. It's not a very big board. It's probably, I think, I'm guessing 16 inches long and 5 inches wide. On one side is a lot of the basic details of the murder of Joe Vukovich's flight, and then of the, you know, the date of the hanging. Then on the backside, it says several years later, or a few years later, Mrs. Shea's husband confessed to killing her on his deathbed. And that's all it said. And so we had to do a little research and to find out when he died. And he didn't die until 1952. So that stirred the imagination, I guess. and it certainly caught Cliff Iverson's eye when he found the board in the house that his father had moved from Missoula, out east of Missoula, back in 1970.
So do you think the person who wrote this had witnessed this confession firsthand? Were they there at his deathbed?
Well, you know, I was hoping to pin that down. I was hoping that maybe it was his daughter, Jerry Shea's daughter, whom he was visiting in Miles City, clear across the state, 500 miles away, when he died. But Cliff is pretty sure that the writing is his own father's. And he has no known connection between his father and Jerry Shea, even though they both lived in western Montana. Well, since Tony Iverson arrived from Norway in 1928 until Jerry Shea died in 1952. So it would have been nice to find that connection, but I could not find it.
Cliff Iverson is pretty sure that the handwriting is his father's then.
Yeah, he actually brought out, showed me some examples of his father's writing. And I'm not an analyst. There's similarities, but still we don't have the explanation why his father would have written that in the first place. And Cliff's speculation and the family's speculation is that he saw the story in old newspapers that were used for insulation on this house that he had moved from Missoula. It was an old house, and for some reason wrote it down at that point. That seems unlikely to me because I could not find any newspapers anywhere that mentioned a confession 30 years later.
I wonder why he wrote it on a board and not a piece of paper.
That's certainly up for speculation. It sounded like he would want to make it more permanent, or, you know, more permanent than a piece of paper. He might have, it might have been the only thing handy if it was, Cliff found it in the garage of the house, and maybe it was the handiest thing he had to write. It was written in what appears to be Carpenter's pencil, and Tony Iverson was a millwright at the Bonner lumber mill. And so Cliff speculates that that was the pencil that he just grabbed out of his pocket that millwrights always carry, and wrote it there. Again, it's just, that seems nebulous. And, you know, it would not be evidence that could anybody would be able to use, for instance, if there was a movement to pardon Joe Vukovich all these years later.
Another odd thing to me, wouldn't someone who had learned of a murder confession go straight to the police instead of writing it on a board and not telling anyone? Or maybe they did, but the police brushed it off. I guess it's really hard to say, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the circumstances of the confession would be great to know. He was at his daughter's home, the daughter that had turned 2.5 the day of the murder when her mother was killed. By 1952, she was married, living in Miles City. The other daughter, who had been 5 at the time of the murder, was married and living in Alaska. And Jerry, earlier in 1952, was in and out of the Missoula hospital. It wasn't, I don't know what it was for, but he was obviously sick. The older daughter from Alaska was noted in the paper, actually, that she was down to visit her father in Stevensville, is where he was living. And that was in July, just after he got out of the hospital for the last time. And then he died in August, about 5 weeks later, in Miles City, 500 miles away. So whether he wanted, before he died, to get this off his chest to his daughters, or whether he he called in somebody in authority, somebody official, to make that confession, that's a mystery. And the strand will probably disappear into history if it was just a deathbed confession to his daughter or daughters. If there's some record out there of a confession in Custer County, where Miles City is, the sheriff that I talked to of Custer County could find no record of it in the coroner's reports.
I know that this is all just complete speculation and us just guessing about this, but my goodness, if this was a real confession that was made to his daughters, I guess he would be clearing his conscience, but also risking eternal hatred from his daughters, who I assume would resent him for it, right?
I would think so. You never know. I don't know what relationship he had with his daughters. He never, according to his obituary, it appears he never got remarried. And so whether he raised those two daughters himself, had some kind of whatever kind of relationship he had with them as a loving father, or maybe as an estranged father in the end, I really don't know. So yes, there probably would have been some bitterness, I would think, of those girls who grew up without a mother.
Again, it's impossible to get into the head of Jerry Shea, of course, but if he was the killer, would a normal man, if he was pushed to that kind of rage, kill his wife and not his wife's lover?
Sure. That's where things get snarled, because, like I say, I think they were both involved in this bootlegging ring, whether it was together or in competition. And then you add in, you know, the love triangle aspect of it. and the fact that Jerry was apparently intimidated by Joe Vukovic, who seemed to have a short temper, and you throw in all that in the mix, how it happened to be that Mrs. Shea was the one who died, is interesting, I guess.
So does the area where the murder happened, does it still look the way it did in 1921?
I think so. There's obviously more modern buildings in the area. Actually, though, it is right across from some what appeared to be railroad warehouses, brick, you know, two-story type warehouses that now have modern businesses in them. And so those still stand along the railroad between First Street and the railroad. And the house, one of the houses on the northwest corner of the Rose Avenue, what was Rose Avenue and North First Street, looks to me like it could easily have been standing back then. So other than all the power lines and the fire hydrants and the garbage dumpsters that are in that little area, it could look very similar, I would think. Especially this time of year.
Oh, right. Yeah. So the death penalty still exists in Montana, right? Is it often used?
That it is not used often. There are two men on death row, as I understand it, right now. The hanging of Joe Vukovic was, I believe, maybe I believe there were maybe 14 other hangings in various counties in Missoula or in Montana after that. The last one was back in Missoula in the same jailhouse during World War II in 1943, where a confessed murderer was hanged. And that one in 1943 was the last hanging. Legal hanging in Montana. Now, with the new state constitution from 1972, et cetera, where the death penalty is legal again, I guess. The execution means of choice is lethal injection, and that has been challenged because of for humanitarian reasons as well. Although I will say that we are far and away far from being the most, compared to our population, we don't have very many men on death row or executions. I think there have been three or four since 1996. So in the last 20-some years, we've had three executions.
So just personally, would you rank this as one of the most infamous murders in Montana history?
I would not, no. And I refer to this book that Tom Donovan wrote, Hanging Around the Big Sky. I mean, it's 2 inches thick. And it covers back in the 1860s, before there was even a Montana, or just shortly thereafter, the vigilantes of Montana are probably by far and away the most famous executioners of bad guys, mostly without a trial. And even in Missoula County, historically speaking, besides the last man to hang in 1943 in Montana was in Missoula. In the 1890, December of 1890, they hanged in the Missoula courtyard four Native Americans, two of them Pendere Indians and two of them Kootenai Indians, for three different depredations. They just chose to do it all at once. And that was quite a scene.
What would you say off the top of your head is the most sensational crime in the history of your state? the one that drew the most press, the one that people in Montana would still know today?
Well, we had the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski.
Sure.
That didn't result in the death sentence. That was in 1996 in Lincoln, 80 miles west of, or east of Missoula. Probably the most sensational over the years was one of the first ones, which has had books written about it, the hanging of Sheriff Henry Plummer in Bannock in a gold camp in 1864, where he was the sheriff who was apparently the head of the road agent gang that was robbing and murdering miners. And so he was kind of the suave sheriff, smooth talker, who no one could believe would be doing these heinous crimes. Well, they caught the vigilantes formed a month before they caught up to him in Bannock and hung him on the gallows outside of the gallows that he built for another execution outside of Bannock. Every other year, they reenact that, the hanging of Sheriff Plummer in Bannock, which is now a state park. I've seen it a couple of times, and it's very lifelike, very realistic, very authentic, and well done on a January Saturday is when they usually have it. So, yeah, in Iowa.
How do they stage the hanging?
Well, they've got it figured out. There's a gallows up the gulch from downtown Bannock, which is essentially a ghost town. And they hanged two other guys with Sheriff Plummer. So they have characters reenacting that. And they march them with the onlookers, with spectators. They catch them in the saloon or in the house in town, and the whole procession follows them up the gulch to the gallows. And there's some kind of harness, you know.
Interesting.
Apparatus that they use, but they do it. They do it very, very well, and you know, slip the hoods over their heads, and the widows to be are, you know, make a scene and so on and so forth. So they do that every other year because our legislature every other year, and the death penalty is always an issue at the legislature, as it is currently right now. They do it in the year, the Januarys that the legislature does not meet, I think, to avoid any kind of political, pushback.
Well, on the outside chance that maybe there are some listeners out there who might know something more about the case or might be willing to help do some research on it, how can they contact you?
Yeah, I think the best way would be just by Gmail.
Okay.
That way I won't lose it. And I think, Eric, I gave you a different email the other day. And maybe I'll give you my Gmail. So if they want to send it to my Gmail, which is unfortunately my name spelled out, Kim Brigeman, the number 2, at gmail.com. So it's KimBrigeman, number 2, at gmail.com. I'd love to hear from anybody.
Excellent. And I will share your article on my Most Notorious Facebook page. If anyone wants to see some photos, read what you wrote, they can find it there. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to keep the story alive. I don't get these opportunities very often as a newspaper guy.
Again, my guest has been Kim Brigeman, reporter and history writer for Montana's Missoulian newspaper. His article is called Curious Find Casts Doubt on 1922 Execution. This has been another episode of The Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.